All right, let's make sure you are in fellowship and continue on here, dealing with close to the end here of chapter 2 of Philippians, and now dealing with the matter of Paul's travels plans, especially as they relate to Epaphroditus and why he's going to send him, and now he gets into sort of the meat of it, explaining his reasoning. And what was going on there with Epaphroditus, Paul, and those in Rome as it related to those in Philippi. So in verse 25, he said, I thought it necessary to send Epaphroditus to you. And essentially the rest of that is somewhat parenthetical. It's explanatory as he describes Epaphroditus both from his perspective and then from the perspective of the Philippians. But you can translate this: I thought it necessary to send to you Epaphroditus because he was longing for you all. And that's where the sentence runs into. That this provides the cause, a marker here, of why he was wanting to send him. Because here is Epide, E-P-E-I-D-E. That's a P. 10 times this is used. It's used as a marker of time, but it's also used as a marker for the cause or reason. So cause is probably here better. Because he was, and then you have this periphrastic construction, which involves, periphrastic means to use more or to say more than you have to communicate what you're saying. And it's usually used for emphasis. He was is the imperfect of Ine. Now, the imperfect of Ine is, here's the present time, at some point in the past. Now, Paul doesn't say when it was, probably the recent past, of course, but been all that long, I don't think. So I would assume that Paul was in Rome for a couple of months, maybe 6 months, before anyone would ever have been dispatched to him. And the fact is, this, as we know, this dispatch, presuming, and we can add a little bit to it just to hedge our bets, presuming the trip took about 2 months. And we're probably sometime now in the spring of 62 AD. Are getting close to it. So how long he had been there? Generally, they didn't want to travel in the winter. Certainly not on the sea, but in other cases, you didn't want to travel in the winter if you didn't have to. For obvious reasons. So how long he had been there, we don't know. But what we do know is that there was this period of time that's expressed by this imperfect of Ine. Because he was, and then you've got distress. He was longing for you all, actually. Longing is epipatheo. E-P-I-P-O-T-H-E-O. I keep wanting to write this in Greek. I don't know what the problem is, but I've got the Greek here, so you can see it. Present active participle, and that's very often how this is used. The periphrastic will use a form of Ine with a participle. The participle emphasizing ongoing action. But again, so did that imperfect of Ine. It emphasized ongoing action there in the past time. So epipatheo means to have a strong desire for something, to yearn for or long for. So he was longing for you all. You got the accusative here, all of you, literally. All of you all, it's a little redundant, but we just translate it, you all. And was distressed. Again, another present active participle, which again symbolizes that this is not a momentary deal, but an ongoing thing he felt. Ade meneo. A-D-E-M-O-N-E-O. Ade meneo is only used 3 times here. It means to be anxious or distressed or deeply bothered by something. So he was deeply distressed, even is fine, because you had heard you got this marker of cause, dioti, which is actually a D-I-O-T-I. It's a compound of dia, D-I-A, and then hoti. Because, or literally through the fact, through that, because you had heard, aorist indicative of akouo. This has, when I translated here, with that pluperfect force because you had heard, A-K-O-U-O, you had heard that he was sick. Aorist active indicative of asteneo. A-S-T-H-E-N-E-O. This word first focuses on weakness and limitations. Obviously, sickness is a pretty big weakness or limitation that we face. So here, it's most likely a constative aorist. He was sick for a period. We don't know for sure how long he was sick, but apparently it wasn't just over and done with. This dragged out for some time, we would think. And he was upset by the fact that they had gotten word. Again, we don't know how they got word, and we'll deal with all of this, because this is one of the reasons they want to reject the writing from Rome in this deal. And we went over this, probably if you remember the introduction now, we went over this in the introduction, and that is they want to eliminate this being from Rome simply because they say it would take too long for all these trips. The back and forth wouldn't be able to do it. But let's say there were 10 trips even. That's a lot. But let's say there were 10 trips between Rome and Philippi. And each trip takes about 2 months. Well, that's 20 months total. And that's even adding a little bit, because the trip was probably more like 7 weeks, 49 or 50 days, rather than a full 2 months. But let's say we allow for that. You could still fit that into that 2-year time frame. I mean, obviously, they'd have to get started real early. But there were nothing like 10 trips made. And many of them, as we're going to see when we deal with this here, have posited 5 trips that you don't have to have. And they say, well, this had to happen this way. Well, no, you can't prove that it did. And where the text is silent, you should be silent if you can. It's kind of important. For indeed, as he goes on here now to explain, you got the conjunction gar introducing an explanation here of why he was distressed. And then here, a chi in an adjunctive sense, for indeed or even. And again, this combination of gar chi here confirms what he's just saying, and it intensifies the information about his illness. And you got the same verb there again. For indeed, he was sick, asteneo. He was sick to the point of death. What you've got here is paraplasios, an adverb actually, P-A-R-A. P-L-E-S-I-O-S. Paraplasios, literally it's an adjective, but it functions as an adverb. And it's describing someone who's come near to death or close to death. So he was sick to the point of death. In other words, he nearly died. That's another just quick way to put it. He nearly died. He was close to an enthanatos, T-H-A-N-A-T-O-S. He was close to death. Physical death is in view here. But strong adversative conjunction, and this sets up a big adversative line here because this is critical to Paul. But God had mercy on him. The God, Hotheos, T-H-E-O-S, had mercy is the verb, eleo, E-L-E-E-O. Eleo. This means to take pity on. It has the idea of mercifulness or pity, to show mercy to someone, to have pity on them, on him. And the autos here, the pronoun, refers to Epaphroditus. He had mercy on him. Not on him only. And actually, and or but would be fine here. You just have the conjunction duh. And again, it is not adversative here. It's signaling an addition. That's really what its most normal function is, to signal some kind of an addition. It can be adversative. It can be connective. It can be, but basically what it's doing is signaling you that there's more information. Further information about God having mercy on him. And it wasn't just on him, as he says here. Him alone, or not on him only, is the way they've translated here. You got the duh here, introductory term, and then not is the negative u, and then autos again, not on him, And then you have this adjective, he had mercy, not on him alone, monos. That means, you know, monad means one, only or alone. But, again, another strong adversative here, but also, you got a chi adjunctive here. Allah was that strong adversative again. But also on me. And these are accusatives here. He had mercy on him and also on me. In order that. Here, so that is the way they've translated it. Here you have the conjunction hina, which introduces an explanation here. It's a negative purpose clause by form. In order that not lupe upon lupe I might have. Is the Greek word order here. In order that, again, so that I would not experience this. So that, in order that not, negative may here, the weaker negative. And then lupe. This means L-U-P-E. Pain, sorrow, or grief, and lupe can refer to physical, mental, emotional, spiritual pain, sorrow, or grief. It's a broad term. And for the lot of the positive believer, it can encompass several of them. You might have a physical issue, a physical pain, but you may have soulish or emotional pain. Lupe very often gets it. This is the term that we use for those who go south. We put them on our lupe list. We're sorry for them. We pray for them only that they'll recover. I'm not praying that God will bless them while they're negative or not pursuing His plan. I just pray that if there's any positive volition there, God will do what's necessary to bring them to their senses. And that's really about all you can offer up in their behalf. If they're not interested in the plan of God, you can't pray them into being. It just doesn't work that way. And that's a total violation. That'd be a complete violation of volition if we could do that. God won't control volition, but He'll let us do it? I don't think so. If God won't control their volition, if He won't make them believe, when it is in their best interest to believe, we can't do it either. Much as we might want to see everybody on the same page, over the years you have these losses that you suffer. But as John said, they went out from us because they were not really of us. They didn't have what it took. And that's one of the big issues that you have to fight, is that people are willing to throw in the towel all too early in many cases. Not enduring the suffering, not. And we've been warned about this again repeatedly. This is one of those kinds of things, though, that you don't necessarily anticipate, but would be difficult. If this guy died on Paul's watch while he was there to minister to Paul, Paul would have significant grief over that, I would think. There might even be some guilt. Not that it's appropriate, because obviously we don't control life or death. This is one of the things that they think guns control life and death. Guns don't. People do. We unfortunately can't control it in the sense we can't keep people alive if they're going to die. And of course, we shouldn't kill people who are going to live. Shouldn't have to say that, but we will. So in order that here, so I would not have sorrow upon, and you have this preposition, which generally means that. It's spatially, it has the idea of on top of something else. That was on, upon, or over the top of it. Sorrow upon sorrow. And this is used here to signify addition. Sorrow or grief is lupe again. And then I might have is echo. And that's just the simplest verb, to have something. And so to have, and then when it's used of emotions, it means to experience. So I would not experience sorrow upon sorrow, or an abundance of sorrow. Sorrow, the idea of sorrow upon sorrow would be sorrow that overwhelms you. Sorrow that is too much, that you can't take. And again, what sort of sorrows are those? Well, we'll have to get into that as we address this. So point one here in verse 26, Paul provides two distinct reasons for his decision to send Epaphroditus back to Philippi immediately. Rather than waiting to see how things progressed, that should be things there, progressed in his own niche. Two, the Greek involves a periphrastic construction with the verb eimi, he was. And again, and the participle of the verb epipatheo. And in fact, there's two participles there, as we're going to see. He was longing for you, to yearn after or to long for. And again, the periphrastic construction signifies this is an ongoing state he's facing. This isn't just a brief deal, happened to him one day, got over it, moved on. This is something that lingers, something that sticks to it. So the imperfect tense of the verb, coupled with the present tense of the participle, indicates that what Paul is describing was not an isolated incident. Rather, it indicates that Epaphroditus had been experiencing this strong emotion for some time. And although a number of interpreters have suggested this was sort of, I think, the interpretation du jour one day, whatever day it was, have suggested that the verb should be understood in the sense that Epaphroditus was homesick, such is not the case. And in fact, I like the way Fee put it. Rather, their view is, as Fee put it, psychologizing, pure and simple. This is evident since Paul had used this same verb earlier in this letter, and it had no implications of homesickness. If you want to make it mean homesick here, then in 1:8, you're going to have to treat it the same way. But you can't make it in 1:8 because Philippi is not Paul's home. So you can't do that. And then to read that into here in the second chapter, or the second chapter, is just as wrong. For God is my witness. Very same verb, how I long for you all. He's not saying I'm homesick. He's just saying I have very strong emotional attachment to you. And again, while we talk about love in terms of agape, in terms of your self-sacrifice, putting the other person first, and all of that, to say that agape doesn't have anything to do with the emotions would be very short-sighted. Obviously, if you're willing to lay your life down for someone, you're going to feel a certain way about him. You may not. But you can't rule out emotions with that word. Like, agape is a word with absent emotion. You just love. You just sacrifice. You do this. But you don't feel any particular way about it. Well, for the pastor, for instance, he loves the congregation. He puts them first by making sure they're fed, by providing their nourishment and what they need. But does that mean he doesn't care about them? Just because he does his job? No, I would think the more you care, the better you'd want to do your job. So again, to make this homesick here is way out of line, doesn't address the deal. Epaphroditus was not homesick. He was missing these people badly, but Paul missed them too. So either case, the fact is, it just deals with this very strong emotion that he had with regard to them. So since Paul had used the verb, also used that verb, epipatheo, to long for or yearn after of himself, this should be understood as an expression how strongly he and Epaphroditus desired to see the Philippians. And there are people like that you'll have in your life, and there are times when you cannot be together. And you might have a longing to see them, and the longing may get intense. And that's just the way it is. And maybe God will work it out, and this is where Paul is kind of, I think, masterful at all of this. We've seen it in not only this book, but in any other books, a number of other books anyway. And that is, he made his plans. He tried to do what he wanted to do, or what he believed God's will was, say, for instance, to get back to Thessalonica. But God, it was prevented. He said Satan prevented it. That Satan shut it down. So, again, as a believer, you make your plans, and you may want to see somebody, and it just may be the time, it may not. You just have to kind of orient to that as to what God's will is in that matter. So the somewhat redundant phrase, all of you all, is used 6 times in this letter. And I got to thinking about that, and I thought, well, why does he use this? Because it is a bit of a redundancy. And I think it's because he's constantly trying to express both the unity and the individuality of that church, the individuals within it that comprise the body, and that all of them are important. That he didn't say, I want to see some of them, but the rest of them I'd rather not. So to emphasize that no one in Philippi is excluded. This is in keeping with the idea of inclusion and unity so prevalent in this letter. And then 8, the second reason Paul provides follows the connective use of the conjunction chi. which continues a second periphrastic construction that uses the imperfect of the verb eimi along with another present participle. And in 9, the verb ade meneo, to be upset, distressed, anxious, or troubled. And those are all synonyms, pretty much. Each one may have its own sort of subtle nuance. But it is somewhat rare, and it's only used 3 times in the New Testament. And 10, the only other usages refer to the emotional state of Jesus Christ when he's in the Garden of Gethsemane contemplating his impending crucifixion. So the verb is a strong one. There's no doubt about that. Matthew 26 are the only other times it's used by God the Holy Spirit in the New Testament. Was in the most troubling event, really, that he ever endured. This is where the battle was finally fought and won. And he took with him Peter and the 2 sons of Zebedee, that'd be James and John, and began to be grieved and distressed. It uses that term we're going to get, what we got in our passage, lupe, but it uses the verbal form. Lupeo is the way they've translated the first verb there. He began to be grieved. He was emotionally stressed. And then he was distressed. Obviously, spiritually, he was grieved as well. I mean, when you're contemplating the loss of your life, I don't think there's any more serious thing you could ever contemplate. And for him, knowing it wasn't just a matter of losing his life, because he had made this statement repeatedly, "No man takes my life from me." It's not as though this has all just gotten out of hand or something and Jesus is going to die accidentally. He said, "I lay my life down. I have the authority. I have the commandment from my Father to lay my life down, and I have the commandment to take it up again." And so, but you still have to undergo this dying, and not just the physical death. We not recognize that it was the spiritual death, his separation from the Father during those 3 hours, from noon to 3 p.m. And these very much describe, by the way, both of these terms are very human emotions, very strong human emotions. And so we limit this at that level, that this is what his humanity was facing. This was the test. I have remained perfect. Now, do I continue to be obedient to God and to bear the sins of the world and endure spiritual death? Or do I disobey and save my own life? And people may say, "Well, God knew he would always do it." Well, yeah, God knew, but the choice was real for him and the test was real. And again, as we have said before, temptability implies peccability. And if he was tempted to fall, he could have fallen. The fact is, he didn't. This is his greatness. So there it's used. And then it's just a parallel here, Mark 14. And I don't remember if he uses the same 2 terms here or... Well, actually, he uses a different one here for the first one. But the last term here, translated troubled, is our ade meneo verb. Troubled. Distressed is the one they use prior to that, and trouble. So the fact, point 11, that Paul uses such strong terms to express the emotions that Epaphroditus was experiencing has caused some to suggest that he was emotionally immature, somewhat unstable because he was homesick and prone to anxiety. Well, does the text say anything like that? I mean, I just want to struggle here with, is there any indication other than your brilliant mind that would suggest to you that this is the case? And sometimes they want to look too much into this. I think it's all pretty straightforward on the surface here. This guy is troubled because people back home think he might die. Now, he's past the might dying part. He's already recovered. But they don't know that. And this really expresses how seriously he took their feelings into account. That this strong term about him longing for you and being distressed It was because of them, not like he was suffering. Well, I might die, and so I'm distressed. Well, you would think that would make you distressed if you thought you were facing death. Doctor, you going to the doctor next week? Then you get your appointment. By the way, you got 7 days to live. Well, that'll shake you up, I imagine. But he cares more about them. He's not concerned about how this is affecting him. He's concerned about how it's affecting them. And if this does not manifest what he had just taught and commanded in the first part of the book, this chapter, putting the needs of others first. These are part of the reasons why he includes these guys here at this point in his letter. Because these are perfect examples of what he's been talking about and perfect models of what Jesus did as he sacrificed his will for the needs and of others and didn't use his place to advance himself. But took into account the needs of others. So again, no, he's not emotionally immature. There's no proof of that. And in fact, is this the kind of guy, if you think about it? Okay, we got this guy, he's kind of weak, he's timid. Let's trust him with a bunch of money and send him out. he can walk around saying, money, I got money. And no. You wouldn't send that kind of a person. So to read that into here, again, is eisegesis. It's reading into the stuff, not reading out. However, even though both of these verbs express deep and strong emotions, feelings, or passions, they should not be taken to imply some sort of immature mindset. So are you going to say that about Jesus then? When he's in the garden, he's immature. He can't handle it, and so, so we're going to just say he's emotionally weak? I don't think I would take that approach. And to take that approach here is unnecessary. And it doesn't accomplish anything other than it makes Epaphroditus look a little worse. And what's their point in that? Because clearly here Paul speaks of him in pretty glowing terms. So maybe they just want to bring him down, from his high horse or something. I don't know. Well, therefore here, even though they express strong emotions, feelings, and passions, they should not be taken to imply some sort of immature mindset or psychological tendency towards anxiety. Everybody is anxious. You say, well, I get anxious. Everybody does. I get anxious. You get anxious. We all get anxious. And now the question is, how do you handle your anxiety? Prozac. That's the way to handle it. No, you need to handle it with doctrine. Now, I'm not saying, by the way, when I make a joke like that, I don't want people thinking, if you're taking some antidepressant, I got to get off of it because Ron's against this. I'm not. I'm for medicine when it works and for people to take what they need. But to suggest that all Western medicine always works equally well and some of it isn't just flat dangerous is wrong. I mean, I think we know all that. You'll watch them put the drug on the market. Remember Celebrex? Wonder how much they paid out on that deal. Because they had to pull it off the market, like they have so many drugs. So, again, you want to use what works, and we're not against drugs, even narcotics, if the person needs them. That's not because this guy's weak and needs some sort of emotional or psychological support. It's just that this is how a normal believer would respond or should respond to these situations, I think. So again, 13 here, therefore his commendation, which he had just given in that previous verse about how great he was. And then to turn around and say, well, he's just very immature and psychologically unstable. But that, again, was that the kind of person? We want to get the most unstable guy in the group and send him out on an important mission. And I don't think so. I don't think he would do that. So his commendation should not be understood as an attempt to gloss over Epaphroditus' problems. Rather, Paul not only understands his feelings, he shares and validates them. Paul felt very much the same way. Now, Epaphroditus may have felt a little more strongly about them thinking he was sick when he wasn't than Paul did. But the fact is, Paul uses that very same term of longing to see the Philippians that he uses here of Epaphroditus. So, again, one of the things, and I remember back way back when, this goes way back, but when I first got on doctrine in the, early 80s and through the mid 80s and even into the 90s, I got the impression from some pastors that emotions were evil, that you shouldn't feel anything, that if you have an emotion, that you're failing as a Christian, which is Nonsense. I mean, emotions are a part of the human experience, and who do you think designed them? Now, I'm not saying our emotions cannot mislead us. I'm not saying that emotions are to be followed as opposed to doctrine at all. Nothing like that. But to say that you have, somebody dies that you love, and you cry. Some people would say, well, look how weak that is. Paul says, I don't want you to grieve as the rest do. And I've heard that said. Oh, they're grieving like the rest. No, just because you cry doesn't mean you're grieving like the rest. Grieving like the rest, again, to me, is that Middle Eastern funeral you watch in Palestine. You know, where they're out there carrying on, screaming, throwing up dust, carrying on like there's... You know, and they had this in Israel. If you remember back, and of course most of you weren't here then, but back in John 9, there with the deal with raising Lazarus from the dead, there was a lot of emotion because there were paid mourners. They were there generating emotion for money. Now, we're not talking, we think that's not the way to approach death. But to say that you have emotions, and even strong emotions, and admit them and acknowledge, what happens if you have some strong emotion and you deny it? You're going to suppress it, right? And it goes down in your stomach, becomes a nice little ball, a knot. And there it will stay. But we don't want that. We have to deal with this stuff and acknowledge, yes, we're humans. We fail. We have strong emotions. We miss people. We long for them. We love them. We want them to make it. And of course, when they don't, yeah, sure it hurts. Sure it hurts when people walk away from the truth. And then claim that they're oriented. That's even worse. But just walking away is bad enough. Of course it's bothersome. But we have to live it. This is a part of the sufferings of Christ. What do you think Jesus would have been wrecked every time somebody walked off from the truth? He had to see that all the time. Literally, probably every day. And certainly we saw it in mass there in John chapter 6. When he gave them the free lunch one day and the next day told them, you're not getting any more free lunch. Well, that turned them off right there, just to start with. But then the bread of life discourse about what constitutes real food, it didn't set well with them either. If you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you have eternal life. So, and he said, many of his disciples would not walk with him after that. They stopped following. The numbers shrank dramatically after that day. And so did that bother Jesus? Well, I'm sure it did. You know, I mean, he sees these people as sheep without a shepherd. He cares about them. That was part of the reason of the feeding. It was in that context that he said, the people are like sheep without a shepherd. And so I feel sorry for them. I'm concerned for them. And so to see him turn away from the truth, of course it bothered him. But you just, these are some of the things you have to suffer as a believer. You're enduring the sufferings of Christ in that regard when you suffer under something like that. So again, this is not a problem. Paul shares these things. Paul shares these same feelings. I've had them. Hopefully you've had them. You have strong feelings for people. Now, obviously our feelings have to be governed with doctrine. We can't just run with our feelings. Because feelings are changeable, more changeable than the weather. It doesn't change much here now. We're locked in. Give us 6 months and we'll be okay. High 80, low 80 degrees, high mid 90s, heat index 110. 60% chance of rain. You can put that on the map for 6 weeks and 6 months in a row. It's about what it's going to be. Unless something changes, of course. Which doesn't change much this time of year. So again, Paul has these feelings. We all have them. To try to knock this guy down over having this. Or that it makes him bad somehow. Or a failure. No, not at all. So some of the emotional distress, point 14. That Epaphroditus endured was caused by the fact that he knew the Philippians had heard about his illness, but had not heard about the fact that he recovered from the illness that almost killed him. And that's one of the issues, of course, here, was how did they find out about it? Again, I think it makes no sense that they would have ever sent this guy off with a large sum of money alone. My guess is there was a group. And so did he fall sick on the way there and start getting sick? And one of them went back and he said, you know, you need to notify them that I'm getting sick or whatever. I don't know. Did they get all the way to Rome before somebody returned there and told him he was sick? We really just don't know. Did they use a letter? They had a mail system. It's not as though people act like, well, they didn't have a cell phone, so they couldn't get on the internet and do it. People still communicated. You know, we did that in America for a lot of years. You know, you communicated via mail. Telephone was a rather late addition in some ways. So he knew, but how did they find out about it? That's the part we're not told. And this is where the interpreters start getting a little too weird. Well, I mean, they get weird anyway, but here in terms of mandating, oh, there had to be this number of trips. We don't know. He could have got halfway to Rome, started getting sick, and said, you know, you need to go back and tell them that if something happens, you know, here's what's going on. So they may have found out 2 weeks after that he was sick. Could have been, if they got all the way to Rome, came all the way back, they wouldn't have known until 7-8 weeks after the fact. But he knew that they knew somehow. And he seemed certain that they knew. 15, this is one of the parts of the letters that have caused some interpreters to reject the fact that Paul was in Rome when he wrote this epistle. They suggest that there was not sufficient time for these events to have occurred the way they are recorded here. And in that regard, they posit 5 trips from Philippi to Rome. The Philippians learn of Paul's imprisonment from someone coming to Rome, from Rome. Well, and we won't get into all of this, but we'll find out, Paul had been in custody for 3 years prior to getting to Rome. So Paul's already been in custody. He's already a prisoner. And to think that they didn't hear about it until he got to Rome, to me, is kind of ludicrous. Because they were far closer to Philippi, where Paul was up there in Caesarea, than they were when they were in Rome. Philippi was much closer to that. There's still some distance, don't get me wrong. But I would think when Paul was taken prisoner there in Jerusalem, and the Romans took him prisoner, and he was being held in a Roman under Roman guard, that this would have spread throughout believers like wildfire, they would have told each other. We need to pray for Paul. That was one of the things they did early, you see it in the book of Acts. When something went wrong, Peter got arrested. They all got together and started praying. Which is as why I encourage you, whenever you have a need, send it out to everybody. Get people praying for you. The prayers of a righteous man avail much. So again, we don't know. I think they would have already known it. They didn't have to wait for somebody coming from Rome to tell them this. I mean, they may have, and no doubt, when they left there to make this hazardous voyage that Paul told them they never should have made, word probably went back, well, they're taking Paul to Rome via this route. So I think people could have known about a lot of this long before anybody from Rome came and told them. Well, B, they assembled an offering. Now that would, you know, I don't know how long it would take, just depending on, you know, what they did. Maybe it'd take a week or two to get their act together or say, hey, we're going to send an offering. If you want to participate, have your offering here by such and such day and we'll take it. We'll take it to Paul. So they assemble an offering and send Epaphroditus to Rome. Now that trip we will not argue with. I don't think you can argue with that one. Someone returns to Philippi from Rome with news of Epaphroditus' illness. But again, I would suggest that they may already have known about it before he got to Rome. Or they could have found out about it after the fact. We just don't know. And then someone returns to Rome with the news that the Philippians are concerned about Epaphroditus. Well, first let me ask you this. Do you think you'd have to send someone to tell him that? Don't you think he would have known? I mean, I would think if some, you know, let's say, put this into our time frame here. God has some deal and I have to leave here and I'm gone for weeks. And you hear about that I'm sick. Well, I'm sure you're going to be concerned. I mean, let's hope. If you're not, shame on you. So, but I wouldn't have to be told that you knew or you were concerned. I would know. I would presume. And I would think Epaphroditus would have done that too. He would have known the Philippians cared about him. That they were he was a part of that group. And so Epaphroditus is sent back to Philippi with this letter. Now, that's the letter we're studying right now, the Philippian letter. Well, 17, since a single trip likely averaged about 2 months. And I rounded up. It was really more like 50 days or so. And that could be obviously made in quicker time than that, depending upon what you were doing and how fast you wanted to make it. They argue that this would have taken almost a year for these trips, which is difficult to fit into the 2-year imprisonment if one allows any significant time between trips. I mean, let's assume there's a couple of weeks or a month in between trips. You got to add another 5 months to that. Well, now you're up to essentially 15 months. And that's the bigger part of 2 years, you know. So outside of the fact that their math is faulty, there's no need to believe that 5 trips were made or even necessary. This view assumes too much, since one can make the argument that only 2, or perhaps 3, trips were actually necessary. And then, the first trip from Rome to Philippi was not necessary, since Paul had been in Roman custody for 3 years prior to his arrival in Rome. This would have allowed plenty of time for the Philippians to become aware of his situation. And I would think, as important as Paul was to the church, to these local churches, but to the church at large at that time, that this is the kind of information that would have spread like wildfire among believers. They would have been on top of it. And we know his enemies would have been happy to spread this information, right? Paul's in jail. God's not for him. I told you, you shouldn't listen to him. You got to get away from him. We're the true apostles. That's what they tell the Corinthians. But no. So I think the fact Paul being in custody would be spread as much by unbelievers as by believers. The enemies of Paul would be happy to tout this and to trumpet it around. Hey, Paul's in trouble. We told you he was trouble. We warned you. And now you see it. He's an enemy of the state. Well, Epaphroditus' trip from Philippi to Rome is certainly necessary. And nobody argues that point. That's the one trip we certainly have to allow. You can't get around that one. It's pretty clear that Epaphroditus brought the money from Philippi to Rome, and you have to have a trip for that. Well, see, given the fact that Epaphroditus was likely carrying a considerable sum of money, and knowing how Paul had conducted himself in regard to monetary situations, it is almost certain that Epaphroditus was accompanied by others on the trip to Rome. And Paul talks about this when you look at the Jerusalem offering. He talked to these churches and he said, basically, I want you to send representatives. A representative or two, how many ever, from each local church that was involved. And this served a couple of things. Number one, when they went with them, they were present to present this offering, which showed Gentile solidarity with the Jews in Jerusalem. But secondly, they were also there to oversee it, to make sure nothing funny was done with the money. And that the money went to where it was supposed to go. They didn't pilfer it. And they didn't use it, say, take campaign funds and use it for a car, like all our politicians do, which is illegal, by the way. And they get caught at it occasionally and get a little wrist slap, and that's about it. But this also, but I think knowing Paul and how diligent he was, you wanted oversight on something like this. And I think when large sums of money are involved, I think any good practicing believer that had much sense would say, okay, we need to see that this is done right. And that's going to involve more than one set of eyes, as you might imagine. So, it would seem that Epaphroditus either fell ill on the journey to Rome or just after arriving there. One of those with him was either sent back or chose to return to Philippi with the news that he was sick. So this view is favored by a few interpreters based on the fact that if he fell ill on the way, continuing the trip to Rome was potentially what placed his life in danger. Because at the end there, he says, he came close to death for the work of Christ. Now, Paul doesn't say when that happened, whether that happened on the way there, whether it was made worse by the journey, or if it happened after he got there. We just don't know. But again, I could also suggest here that they may not have had to make the return trip from Rome. They may have sent a letter. So you don't have to have 8 weeks for that. The mail service, again, developed under the Phoenicians way back when was pretty efficient, really. for that time in history, just like ours is today. So again, we don't know what place is live in danger, but and again, even if they all continued to roam, that trip back to Philippi would only take an average of about 2 months. And that's a trip that I put in parentheses. Is it a legitimate trip? Did it have to be made? Did they send a letter? There was other ways this could have been done. Maybe somebody was already traveling back to Philippi and said, I'll take the information. Or maybe they passed some believers returning to Philippi on the trip there, gave them the information while they were on the way. So there's a bunch of variables in here that they don't necessarily account for. And you don't have to have all these trips. The fourth trip is entirely unnecessary. That's somebody coming back to Rome with the fact that the Philippians are concerned. Since Epaphroditus would have known that whoever returned to Philippi would have informed those people about his illness. And he would not have needed a message from the Philippians to understand that they knew about his situation. Again, if I were taken away and were gone for some time, months, and you found out I was sick and maybe dying, I don't think I'd need to send back, hey, do you guys care? Is anybody interested? I think I would know that. I think I would know that people were concerned. And so, H here, given the importance of the mission of Epaphroditus, it only makes sense to believe that the Philippians trusted him and held him in high regard. And of course they would be concerned about one of their own. And who knows? I mean, this guy might have been sort of, you know, the hub of the church. Who knows how important the guy was in terms of the local church itself? What part he played there? We certainly would have to say he was a trusted emissary, though. And that term, of course, sending out with instructions and authority the emissary who represents them and does their bidding toward Paul. So again, the five trips, you don't have to make five trips. You could cut it down to three and, to be honest, perhaps two. So now their arguments really don't hold water, because with two trips, you're talking about a total maybe of 4 months. And while we might think that's a long time, obviously travel wasn't as right. They didn't jump on a plane and get bogged down at the airport. They traveled, you know, by land for the most part. You did have to cross some water to get there on the Via Appia. As the Via Ignatia ended there, you had to cross to get over to Rome to hit the Via Appia. All roads there lead to Rome. So 19 here, so Paul goes on in verse 27 to explain about the severe nature of the illness. The phrase, kaigar, here, for indeed, is both explanatory and intensive. And that's there in verse 27 right at the beginning of it, for indeed, the very first two words there, implying that the statement about Epaphroditus' sickness was an understatement. So 20, although nothing is said of the nature of his illness, Paul emphasizes the fact that it was something so severe that it had left Epaphroditus at the point of death. And of course, as we know, when you're traveling, and obviously they use certain things, certain precautions when they travel. But, you know, I watch some of these survival shows, and if you get Giardia or Streptococcus or some of these other pneumococcus, you get some of these things. You can get them out of the water you drink. You know, there was a big salmonella outbreak, I think, or listeria it was. And it's big Olaf Creamery. Don't go there. No, that's where they said they think it started. That they traced four or five people back to that place. So, at any rate, so when he's sick... But how sick is he? Well, he's really sick, and it's a bit of an understatement to say that he was just sick. That what he had could have been something, it was something, in fact, very serious. So 21, although Epaphroditus had been at death's door, Paul uses the strong adversity of conjunction Allah, but, exclamation mark, to introduce the matter of God's mercy that had been extended to both Paul and to Epaphroditus. In 22, it is worth noting that Paul did not say that God restored Epaphroditus to health, or that he delivered him. Now, there's language he could have used here. He could have said God healed him. I mean, we got a verb for that. Actually, a couple of verbs. But God had mercy on him. And you might have expected him here to say that. God healed him. But he doesn't say that. He talks about it in terms of God's mercy. So it is worth noting that he didn't say he had restored him to health or that he delivered him from death, but simply that his recovery is viewed as an act of God's mercy. And I think, given the nature of all of this, God had mercy on him. Paul ultimately attributes his healing to God, I presume. Now, we don't know how that came about. There are, as you know, a number of ways to get healed. One of the issues becomes, you know, was Paul, why didn't Paul heal him? We know that Paul certainly manifested the ability to heal people in his early ministry there. But one of the things, and we'll look at this later, we won't get to it today, but one of the things is that after about probably 59, maybe, 59 A.D., I can't see if Paul ever healed anybody else again after that. There's no record of it. Now, I'm not saying it didn't happen. And so when we're talking about healing, we're talking about somebody who had the ability supernaturally, whether they laid hands on them or not, it's really irrelevant, but to heal the person, to take away their sickness. Now, that can happen, again, through a miraculous occurrence. God can do it. And even though men cannot heal, God still can. We don't think, well, just because the temporary gift of healing, like tongues, was done away with, that God doesn't heal people any longer. God acts in his own sovereign ways still. But I don't think he's using Ernest Angley. I don't think he's using Swagger. I don't think he's using any of these other people that claim to be his tools. Oh, they're tools, all right. Well, God had mercy on him. And again, he doesn't say how he did it, but he really talks about it mostly in terms of how of the benefit, the merciful benefit that this was for Paul. So while there is no doubt about his recovery, again, Paul does not provide any information as to how Epaphroditus was restored to health, other than just attributing it to God. And again, like I say, you could have a number of ways you can get healed of stuff. Some may, you know, surgery may be required to heal you of certain things. You can have surgery. You can have, some things can be healed with antibiotics. You just take some pills, and that'll heal. Other things can be healed. God can obviously intervene and do that. Some things can be healed, we might say healed, I'll use it advisedly, but through physical therapy and stuff like that, a person can be restored to health after whatever they faced. And it obviously would be something significant. So one might wonder, again, why Paul did not simply heal Epaphroditus. But he doesn't say anything about it, and he doesn't even say he tried or it didn't work or any of that. It's just ignored. Since he had clearly exhibited this ability, the ability to heal people was something Paul manifested during his ministry. Acts chapter 14. Eight through 10. At Lystra, a man was sitting who had no strength in his feet. He was lame from his mother's womb, who had never walked. I like the way this is built in here. No strength in his feet, okay. Lame from the womb, that means okay. That means he had never taken a step. Who had never walked, if you didn't get all that. And this man was listening to Paul as he spoke, who, when he fixed his gaze upon him and had seen that he had the faith to be made well, he said with a loud voice, "Stand upright on your feet." And he leaped up and he began to walk. And then, of course, this is where they start treating him like gods. And when the crowd saw what he had done, they raised their voice, saying in the Lyconian language, "The gods have become like men and have come down upon us." And our time is gone. We'll stop there. We'll be ready to finish this up here on Tuesday, get through these verses here in Acts, and continue on. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to study these things. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our Christian lives and growth, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.